He was an associate pastor and youth minister at the historic Fourth Baptist Church in Richmond, Virginia, when I was the supervising federal prosecutor in that city in the late 1990s. The senior pastor at his church was the charismatic mayor of Richmond, Leonidas B. Young. Unfortunately, Mayor Young was a bit too charismatic for his own good. Although married with children, he was simultaneously carrying on an ambitious number of affairs with other women. To maintain those relationships in the face of some sexual performance issues, Young had undergone an expensive mechanical penile implant, which then catastrophically failed, leading to additional procedures and costs. With his medical bills and purchases of gifts, trips, and hotels for multiple paramours, Young was struggling financially. Sadly, he decided to use his government position to raise cash and turned to his associate pastor to help him do it. At the time, Richmond was considering privatizing city cemeteries. Executives of one company interested in bidding on the cemeteries met with Young. The mayor told them their chances of winning the bid would be materially enhanced if they hired certain people, such as his junior minister at Fourth Baptist, as consultants. The company then wrote checks for thousands of dollars to that junior minister, among others. Bank records showed the minister cashed the checks and then funneled the money to the mayor. My fellow prosecutor Bob Trono and I met with the young minister. There was something about him that made me want to help him. I looked him directly in the eye and said I believed he was a good person and that he had done something as a favor to his mentor and senior pastor at his church, Mayor Leonidas Young. From what we could tell, the young minister hadn't kept any of the money he'd helped Mayor Young embezzle. "Admit this," I told him, "and you will be okay. Lie, and I will have to prosecute you for it." "Mayor Young will turn on you someday," I told him. He began to sweat, but he insisted the cemetery company had hired him for his expertise and that he had not given any money to Young. I felt deep sadness as the meeting ended because I could see the future and what it held for a young pastor from Richmond who had a promising career ahead of him. Leonidas Young was indicted, pled guilty to racketeering, and was sentenced to federal prison. As part of an effort to reduce the length of that sentence, he named the associate pastor as one of his money launderers. The young minister was indicted and convicted of lying during the investigation. At the trial, prosecuted by Bob Trono, Leonidas Young testified against him. The young pastor was sentenced to 15 months in federal prison for lying. I have left his name out of my book because I hope he has made a good and happy life after prison. As I stared out of my Manhattan office window and remembered that young minister, I was suddenly ashamed of myself. He was not famous. I was probably the only person outside Richmond who even knew his name. And here I was, the United States Attorney in Manhattan, hesitating to prosecute Martha Stewart because it would bring criticism. I was actually considering letting her go because she was rich and famous. What a miscarriage of justice. What a coward I was. I asked Dave Kelly to find out how many people had been indicted in the United States the previous year for lying to federal investigators. How many regular people lied and then paid dearly for it? The answer was 2,000. Kelly told me I needed to stop wringing my hands. This was the right thing to do and I should get on with it. He was right. I told my staff to indict Martha Stewart and decided Karen Seymour should lead the case at trial. Charging Martha Stewart was my first experience with getting a lot of hate and heat for a decision that had been carefully and thoughtfully made. People just could not, for the life of them, understand how I could make a mountain out of a molehill in an effort to ruin Martha Stewart. I was obviously out of control, making decisions that no reasonable person could support. The onslaught was bracing, but I was comfortable we had made the right decision and in the right way. It would also prove to be good practice for a future I couldn't have imagined back then. Stewart was convicted and sentenced to 5 months at the federal prison in Alderson, West Virginia. The Stewart experience reminded me that the justice system is an honor system. We really can't always tell when people are lying or hiding documents. So when we are able to prove it, we simply must do so as a message to everyone. People must fear the consequences of lying in the justice system, or the system can't work. There was once a time when most people worried about going to hell if they violated an oath taken in the name of God. That divine deterrence has slipped away from our modern cultures. In its place, people must fear going to jail. They must fear their lives being turned upside down. They must fear their pictures splashed on newspapers and websites. People must fear having their name forever associated with a criminal act if we are to have a nation with the rule of law. Martha Stewart lied, blatantly, in the justice system. To protect the institution of justice and reinforce a culture of truth-telling, she had to be prosecuted. I'm very confident that, should the circumstance arise, Martha Stewart would not lie to federal prosecutors again. Unfortunately, many others who crossed my path would continue to commit the same foolish act. As United States Attorney in Manhattan, I reported to the Deputy Attorney General at the Department of Justice in Washington. The Deputy Attorney General, often called the DAG, was the number two official, the Chief Operating Officer of the department. Everyone in the organization, with the exception of the Attorney General's small personal staff, reported to the DAG, who reported to the Attorney General. It was a crazy organizational chart, one you could only find in the government. But I figured it likely made for an interesting job. In the summer of 2003, Larry Thompson, who was then serving in the post, came to see me in Manhattan. He was burned out and told me he would be leaving in the fall. He intended to recommend to the George W. Bush White House that I replace him as Deputy Attorney General. Was I interested? The answer was yes. I loved being United States Attorney, but New York, as before, was not a great situation for me or my family. For cost-of-living reasons, we lived 50 miles north of my office. The rough commute made it very hard for me to see Patrice and the kids as much as I would have liked. It meant plenty of missed recitals, games, and parent-teacher conferences. I once left my office at 4 p.m. for a 6 p.m. Little League game, and because of the hellish commute, missed nearly the entire game. That kind of thing made me ache. It was not who I wanted to be. If we could move the kids to Washington, I knew I would have a job that would keep me plenty busy, but I also knew I could avoid 3 or 4 hours commuting every day. Of course, there was danger in moving closer to the political heart of the country. One New York journalist captured the views of many of my colleagues when he wrote a piece titled, "Mr. Comey Goes to Washington," saying, "There was no doubt I would retain my sense of humor when I moved to Washington. The harder question was whether I would lose my soul." I confess I shared the concern, but the move would be best for my family, and how bad could it be? So I traveled to Washington to meet with President George W. Bush's White House counsel, Alberto Gonzalez. We met in his office on the second floor of the West Wing. This wasn't my first visit to the White House counsel's suite of offices. In 1995, I had worked briefly for the Senate committee investigating Bill and Hillary Clinton's investments in an Arkansas development called Whitewater and a variety of related issues. One of those issues involved the suicide of President Clinton's deputy White House counsel, Vince Foster, and the subsequent handling of documents left in his office. During my 5 months on the committee legal staff, I was assigned to visit the second floor of the West Wing to examine the suite of offices in which Foster had worked. One of the questions the committee had was whether First Lady Hillary Clinton, or anyone acting on her behalf, went to Foster's office after his death and removed documents. I left the investigation long before any conclusions were reached, but I can recall pacing off the distance between Hillary Clinton's office on the second floor and the White House counsel's suite. I had also been to the West Wing in the spring of 2001. As an assistant United States attorney in Richmond, I was handling a terrorism case and expected the indictment in the case to accuse Iran of funding and directing the devastating 1996 attack on a United States Air Force barracks in Saudi Arabia that killed 19 Americans and wounded hundreds. Such an accusation would have foreign policy implications, and the new Bush administration gathered its senior national security team to hear Attorney General John Ashcroft's explanation as to why the accusation against Iran was well-founded. Ashcroft's staff decided I would accompany him to the White House, but sit outside the Situation Room meeting, just in case he needed me as a resource for details. I was relaxed and enjoying my first visit to the Situation Room, because I had no speaking role and wasn't even in the meeting. I could just look around and soak it in. The soaking didn't last long. Soon I was underwater. Minutes after the door to the secure meeting room closed, it opened again, and there stood the Secretary of State, Colin Powell. "Who's the prosecutor? You the prosecutor?" he barked, fixing his gaze on me. "Yes, sir," I stammered. "Get in here," he ordered. Apparently the start of the meeting had not gone well. General Powell ushered me into the small conference room and directed me to a seat at the table, directly across from him and the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld. The National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, sat at the head of the table. I sat between the slightly flushed-looking Attorney General and FBI Director Louis Freeh. For the next 20 minutes, the two strong-willed cabinet secretaries grilled me about my case and my evidence as I sweated through my suit. When they ran out of questions, they asked me to leave. I walked out numb while the meeting continued. Several weeks later, I got the approval to include the accusation that Iran was behind the Khobar Towers attack. Now here I was, back again. The main floor of the West Wing is home to grand, high-ceilinged offices, including, of course, the Oval Office. It always seemed to me that the architects got the space for those high ceilings by taking it from the levels above and below, especially the basement. Down there, where I would spend so much of my later career in national security meetings, the door frames were about 6 feet 7 inches high. To navigate, I would discreetly bob my head down as if nodding to an unseen companion as I walked. I had no idea how finely calibrated my ducking was until I got new soles and heels on a pair of dress shoes during the George W. Bush administration. Apparently, this refurbished footwear made me about a half inch taller than usual. Rushing, so as not to be late to a Situation Room meeting with the president, I did the usual bob and smacked my head so hard that I rocked backwards, stunned. A Secret Service agent asked me if I was okay. I said yes and continued walking, stars in my eyes. As I sat at the table with the president and his national security team, I began to feel liquid on my scalp and realized I was bleeding. So I did the obvious thing. I kept tilting my head in different directions to keep the running blood inside my hairline. Heaven only knows what President Bush thought was wrong with me, but he never saw my blood. The top floor, where Gonzalez had his office, was only slightly less claustrophobic, with small windows jammed against the low ceiling. I was relieved when we sat. Gonzalez, the White House counsel who had worked for Bush when he was governor of Texas, was a warm, friendly, and almost painfully soft-spoken person. Most conversations with him involved awkward pauses. I don't remember him asking me much at my interview to be Deputy Attorney General. He said the White House was looking for someone strong enough to stand up to John Ashcroft. He wanted to know whether I thought I could do that. That struck me as an odd question to ask about the president's handpicked Attorney General. But as I was quickly learning, Washington was a city where everyone seemed to question other people's loyalties and motivations, most often when they weren't in the room. Ashcroft was a conservative who had considered running for president in 2000, the year that saw George W. Bush elected. Although I couldn't see it from my job in Manhattan, there was tension between the White House and Ashcroft over the perception that the Attorney General was preparing his own political future and that his interests didn't align entirely with President Bush's. I didn't know whether any of that was true, but assured the White House counsel that I would not be cowed by anyone and that I would always try to do the right thing. That answer seemed to satisfy him, at least then. Gonzalez and the political higher-ups in the Bush White House approved me for the position. I met briefly with Ashcroft, who already knew me well, and in December 2003, I moved into an office at the Department of Justice headquarters and began moving the family to the Washington suburbs. The job of the Deputy Attorney General came with a staff of about 20 lawyers to help with the heavy workload and the various demands of 100 others who reported directly to me. Although I had been in federal law enforcement for 15 years, the DAG position was my first chance to work on a near-daily basis with cabinet members. My immediate boss, of course, was John Ashcroft, who, despite Gonzalez's implication, I found to be warm, decent, and committed to his job over his own ambitions. We were cordial with each other, but never close, something I attributed to the 18-year gap in our ages and our very different styles. Although he laughed easily and enjoyed team sports, I'd once played a rough game of basketball against him and failed despite great effort to knock him down. Ashcroft was formal in many respects. A deeply religious man, he didn't dance or drink or curse, and he disdained some of the more colorful turns of phrase I like to use. One day he held me back after a meeting in his office to gently chastise me for the language I used in a meeting that had just ended. He explained that he viewed the office in which he sat as something he held in trust for the American people. I said I very much agreed. He went on, "Given that, I would ask that you be attentive to your language." I gave him a blank look because I couldn't recall using any epithets in the meeting that had just ended. I didn't curse much, but I did on occasion for emphasis and effect. "What did I say?" I asked, mystified. He looked visibly uncomfortable at the prospect of repeating what I had said. It must have been an F-bomb, I reasoned. How could I not remember that?
It rhymes with word, Ashkraut finally said.
I racked my brain for four-letter words that fit his description. Then I remembered. At some point during our discussion about a case, I used the word turd, as in the phrase, turd in the punch bowl. Trying not to smile, I apologized and said I would be more careful in the future. My position also occasionally afforded me the privilege of visiting the Oval Office. My first visit was in late 2003 when I substituted for Attorney General Ashcroft at President Bush's daily terrorism threat briefing. For years after 9/11, every morning President Bush was in town, he met with the leaders of the counterterrorism agencies, which included the FBI and the Department of Justice. I was nervous about these meetings for a couple reasons. Obviously, I didn't want to embarrass myself or my department by saying anything stupid. But I was also going to a meeting with the President of the United States in an office that is hallowed ground in the life of my country. And in 2003, 2 years after the 9/11 attacks, there was no higher priority agenda item than what we were discussing. This was my first meeting with the leader of the free world. As I sat there, I couldn't get over how brightly lit the place was. There was a ring of lights in the recessed ceiling that lit the place like the noonday sun. I didn't have to speak in this meeting unless called upon, so I let my eyes sweep over the faces that were familiar from TV. The President, Vice President Dick Cheney, FBI Director Bob Mueller, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, and Secretary of Homeland Security Tom Ridge. In that moment, something hit me. It's just us. I always thought that in this place there would be somebody better. But it's just this group of people, including me, trying to figure stuff out. I didn't mean that as an insult to any of the participants who were talented people, but we were just people, ordinary people in extraordinary roles in challenging times. I'm not sure what I expected, but I met the top of the pyramid and it was just us, which was both comforting and a bit frightening. Suddenly Bob Dylan was in my head, singing, "What looks large from a distance, close up ain't never that big." One of the first cases that I stepped into in my new role at the Justice Department was another case about lying in the justice system. In June 2003, a couple of months after the invasion of Iraq, an article by reporter Robert Novak had revealed the name of a covert CIA employee. The revelation had come days after the CIA employee's husband had written a newspaper opinion piece attacking one of the Bush administration's main rationales for the war in Iraq, namely, that Saddam Hussein was trying to acquire nuclear material. Speculation was rampant that members of the Bush administration had illegally disclosed the name of this CIA employee to Novak in retaliation for the negative article. Novak attributed his reporting to two Bush administration sources. As the scandal widened, it soon became apparent that at least three, and as many as six, Bush officials had spoken to reporters about the covert CIA employee. Richard Armitage, the Deputy Secretary of State, was one official who freely admitted mentioning the CIA employee's name to Novak. In fact, he had called the Justice Department shortly after the investigation began. He explained that he hadn't intended to reveal classified information. He had just been gossiping with Novak and didn't realize what he had done. The identity of Novak's second source was President Bush's chief political advisor, Karl Rove. Rove had a conversation with Novak, in which Novak mentioned that the author of the critical opinion piece on Iraq was married to a CIA employee. Rove said something like, "Oh, you heard that too." Although it doesn't seem like great journalistic craft, Novak took this as confirmation of what he had learned from Armitage. But there was also evidence that a third official, the Vice President's Chief of Staff, Louis Scooter Libby, spoke to numerous reporters about the CIA employee. By the time I became Deputy Attorney General, Libby had been interviewed by the FBI and admitted doing so, but said he only knew about the CIA employee from a reporter. Like Armitage, Libby maintained that he was just passing gossip, not proactively disseminating the name of a covert agent. Unfortunately for Libby, the reporter Libby named, NBC News Washington Bureau Chief Tim Russert, had been interviewed by the FBI and said that Libby was lying. Russert hadn't passed along the covert agent's name to Libby. 3 years later, a jury would conclude the same thing. Libby lied to the FBI.
This was one of my early experiences in Washington of people deciding motivations based on their partisan allegiance. To Democrats, it was obvious that key members of a Republican administration were subverting justice to undermine and punish their critics. To Republicans, it was just as obvious that this was a witch hunt against people who made an inconsequential mistake. My job would make at least one of these groups, or tribes, very unhappy. The law prohibiting the disclosure of the identity of a covert intelligence agent required specific and evil intent. Under the relevant statute, it was not enough to show that the people who disclosed the agent's identity were stupid or careless. We had to prove that these men knew the CIA employee was undercover, that they also knew that revealing the name was against the law. Based on what we knew to that point, it seemed unlikely that we could prove, at least beyond a reasonable doubt, that Armitage or Rove had acted with the required criminal intent in speaking with Novak and other reporters. Novak backed their story that this had been gossip or a mistake. There was likely not enough evidence to prove otherwise. That put the Department of Justice in a tough spot. Though the people investigating the case were professionals, I knew that it would be very difficult, if there was insufficient evidence, for a department led by Republican John Ashcroft to credibly close an investigation against his colleagues in the same administration without recommending charges. We would also never want to bring charges just to avoid an accusation of conflict. Complicating matters was the fact that Karl Rove had managed one of John Ashcroft's political campaigns back in his home state of Missouri before Ashcroft became Attorney General. On top of that, Scooter Libby, whose conduct still needed to be sorted out, was a senior White House official with whom Ashcroft and senior Department of Justice officials interacted frequently. The credibility of the Department of Justice is its bedrock. The American people must see the administration of justice as independent of politics, race, class, religion, or any of the many other things that divide humans into tribes. We had to do everything we could to protect the department's reputation for fairness and impartiality, its reservoir of trust and credibility. Ashcroft understood that, and when I met with him to discuss my recommendation that he recuse himself from the case, he agreed. I immediately appointed Patrick Fitzgerald, then serving as the United States Attorney in Chicago, as special counsel to oversee the investigation. Although Fitzgerald was a political appointee and a close friend of mine, he had a strong reputation for independence, and as the U.S. Attorney in Chicago, was far enough away not to be seen as part of the executive branch leadership. I went one step further. Because I was also a senior political appointee of President Bush, I delegated to Fitzgerald all my powers as acting attorney general. I remained his supervisor, but he didn't need to ask me for permission to take any step in the case, which emphasized the independence of the investigation. In December 2003, I held a press conference to announce the appointment. The Department of Justice routinely makes press announcements of significant developments in its work, including decisions to bring public charges or lawsuits or the resolution of those cases. In matters of significant public interest, the department has long confirmed investigations and reported the completion of significant investigations without charges. Anytime a special prosecutor is named to look into the activities of a presidential administration, it is big news, and predictably my decision was not popular at the Bush White House. A week after the announcement, I substituted for the Attorney General at a cabinet meeting with the president. By tradition, the Secretaries of State and Defense sit flanking the President at the Cabinet Room table in the West Wing of the White House. The Secretary of the Treasury and the Attorney General sit across the table, flanking the Vice President. That meant that as the substitute for the Attorney General, I was at Vice President Dick Cheney's left shoulder. Me, the man who had just appointed a special prosecutor to investigate his friend and most senior and trusted advisor, Scooter Libby. As we waited for the president, I figured I should be polite. I turned to Cheney and said, "Mr. Vice President, I'm Jim Comey from Justice." Without turning his face to me, he said, "I know. I've seen you on TV." Cheney then locked his gaze ahead as if I weren't there. We waited in silence for the president. My view of the Brooklyn Bridge felt very far away. I had assured Fitzgerald at the outset that this was likely a 5 or 6 month assignment. There was some work to do, but it would be a piece of cake. He reminded me of that many times over the next 4 years as he was savagely attacked by the Republicans and right-leaning media as some kind of maniacal Captain Ahab, pursuing a case that was a loser from the beginning. Fitzgerald had done exactly as I expected once he took over. He investigated to understand just who in the government had spoken with the press about the CIA employee and what they were thinking when they did so. After careful examination, he ended in a place that didn't surprise me on Armitage and Rove. But the Libby part, admittedly a major loose end when I gave him the case, turned out to be complicated. Libby not only lied about his interaction with Tim Russert, claiming that he'd heard the covert agent's name from him, but 8 Bush administration officials testified they talked to Libby about the covert agent's name. More evidence revealed that Libby had proactively discussed the CIA employee with reporters at the vice president's request to push back on stories critical of the administration's basis for invading Iraq. Why Libby, an attorney who graduated from Columbia Law School, lied is not clear. Maybe he didn't want to admit that the leak started at the vice president's office, which would have caused political embarrassment, or he didn't want to admit to an angry President Bush that he had been among the leakers. It took Fitzgerald 3 years of litigation to get to a place where he charged, tried, and convicted Libby of making false statements in a federal investigation, perjury, and obstruction of justice. Republican loyalists howled that he was persecuting Libby because prosecutors could never prove the underlying crime, the intentional leaking of a covert agent's name with prior knowledge of its illegality. Of course, these were the same Republicans who passionately believed that President Bill Clinton's lies under oath over an affair with an intern simply had to be pursued because obstruction of justice and perjury strike at the core of our system. Meanwhile, Democrats, who 6 years earlier attacked the case against Bill Clinton as a silly lie about sex, had discovered in the Libby case that they cared deeply about obstruction of justice crimes when the obstructors were Republicans. I would discover in the coming months that the pressures to bend the rules and to make convenient exceptions to laws when they got in the way of the president's agenda were tempting. And it was a temptation fed by the urgency of the topic and the nature of the people around the president, people who couldn't take the long view or understand the importance to the country of doing things the right way, no matter the inconvenience. They would be painful, exhausting lessons in the importance of institutional loyalty over expediency and politics, and more preparation for the future I couldn't yet see. Chapter 6. On the Tracks. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you. Rudyard Kipling, If. It was after 7 p.m. on March 10th, 2004. Another long, hard day as Acting Attorney General of the United States, a post I'd temporarily assumed on behalf of an ailing John Ashcroft that had put me in the center of an ugly battle with the Bush White House. It was about to get even uglier. My security team was driving me in an armored black Suburban, headed west on Constitution Avenue, past the museums, the Washington Monument, and the South Lawn of the White House. Senior government officials are assigned protective details based on threat assessments. As the United States Attorney of Manhattan, I didn't have one. But since 9/11, the Deputy Attorney General was driven in an armored Suburban and shadowed by armed Deputy U.S. Marshals. At the end of a long day, I was tired and ready to get home. Then my cell phone rang. On the line was David Ayers, Attorney General John Ashcroft's Chief of Staff. Ayers was one of those rare people who seemed to grow calmer in the middle of a storm. And there was a metaphorical hurricane hitting, so his voice was stone cold. Ayers had just gotten off the phone with Janet Ashcroft, who had been keeping vigil at her husband's bedside at George Washington University Hospital. Attorney General Ashcroft had been hospitalized with acute pancreatitis, so severe that it had immobilized him with pain in the ICU. Minutes earlier, Ayers reported, the White House operator had attempted to put a call through to the ailing Attorney General from President Bush. I knew what this was about. So did Ayers. And so did the savvy Janet Ashcroft, who, like her husband, was a sharp and accomplished attorney. Janet Ashcroft had refused the call. Her husband was too sick, she said, to talk to the president. Undaunted, President Bush then told her he was sending his counsel, Alberto Gonzalez, and his chief of staff, Andrew Card, to the hospital to discuss a vital matter of national security with her husband. She immediately alerted Ayers, who called me. After finishing the call, I spoke in an unusually sharp voice to the United States Marshal Service driver. "Ed, I need to get to George Washington Hospital immediately." The urgency in my tone was all he needed to hit the emergency lights and begin driving as if the armored car had dropped onto a NASCAR track. From this moment forward, I was in a race, a literal race against two of the president's most senior officials in one of the wildest, most improbable moments in my entire career. The deputy attorney general job, especially in the years immediately after 9/11, was incredibly stressful. The more stressful the job, the more intentional I've always been about helping my team members find joy in our work. Laughter is the outward manifestation of joy, so I believe if I'm doing it right and helping people connect to the meaning and joy in their work, there will be laughter in the workplace. Laughter is also a good indication that people aren't taking themselves too seriously. When I was Deputy Attorney General, as part of that search for joy and fun, I sometimes engaged in a bit of staff tourism. If I was going to a large White House meeting, for example, I would look to take a member of my staff who hadn't been there before. Usually this was a fun experience for them. Once, it almost went horribly wrong. One of President Bush's major initiatives involved finding ways, consistent with the law, for various departments and agencies to make grants to faith groups. Most agencies, such as the Department of Justice, had an office devoted to this faith-based initiative. In 2004, President Bush summoned the leaders of the departments to give him a report on their progress. I was attending for justice. Shortly before the meeting, I learned that each principal meeting participant, which is what I was, could bring a plus one, meaning a staff member, to support me. I knew our faith-based work well, so I didn't need a plus one. But it occurred to me that Bob Trono, one of my most valuable staff members, had never been to a White House meeting. Bob had been a federal prosecutor with me in Richmond, and handled the Leonidas Young case, including the prosecution of the young minister who lied for Mary Young. I asked him to come to Washington and help me oversee the United States Marshal Service and the Federal Bureau of Prisons. These were vital parts of the Department of Justice, but they rarely got White House attention. I thought it would be fun for him to get a chance to go. When I suggested the idea, however, Bob wasn't feeling it. He didn't know anything about the faith-based efforts, literally nothing, and didn't feel comfortable going to a briefing with the President of the United States on the subject. I replied that I would do all the talking and didn't need his help. After further protests and reassurances, he reluctantly agreed. "Don't worry," I said. "I got this. I'm not going to screw you." Two things, besides me, screwed Bob. First, before the faith-based meeting was to start, I was unexpectedly called to a meeting in the Situation Room at the White House that went longer than I expected. Second, President Bush, who was not with me in the Situation Room, continued his disturbing pattern of starting meetings early. This was not quite as disruptive as President Clinton's notorious tardiness, but having a president occasionally start early meant everyone had to show up well ahead. Soon after becoming Deputy Attorney General, I missed a morning terrorism briefing with the president because, arriving 15 minutes early, I decided to go to the bathroom just outside the Oval Office, known to my family as the highest potty in the land, and returned to find the Oval Office door already closed and the meeting underway. I had no idea what the protocol was for entering an Oval Office meeting in progress, and I was new, so I didn't test it. I left. A nervous Bob found a chair against the wall in the Roosevelt Room, far back from the action. He could see an empty spot at the table, where my name was spelled out on both sides of a triangular tent card. And true to form, George W. Bush walked into the room ahead of schedule and with a look of impatience. Poor Bob. Bush could be impatient, and it drove me nuts that he started things early, but I was struck by his strong and occasionally devilish sense of humor. That year, 2004, he was in the thick of his re-election battle against Democrat John Kerry, who was hammering him for presiding over what Kerry called a jobless economic recovery. In one of our daily morning terrorism meetings with the president, FBI Director Bob Mueller told him that a suspected al-Qaeda operative named Babar, whom we were closely monitoring, had just gotten a second job in New York. Mueller, not known as a comedian, then paused, turned his head toward me, and added, "And then Jim said..." Bush looked at me, and so did Vice President Cheney. I froze. Before our meeting, Mueller and I had discussed Babar's second job, and I'd made a private joke to the FBI director that I hadn't expected to repeat to the president, who could occasionally display a temper. Time slowed down, way down. I didn't reply. The president prompted me. "What'd you say, Jim?" I paused, and then, horrified, plunged in. "Who says you haven't created any jobs? This guy's got two." To my great relief, Bush laughed heartily. Cheney did not. On the way out of the Oval Office, I tugged Mueller's arm. "You're killing me," I said with a smile. "Don't ever do that to me again." "But it was funny," he replied, with the grimace that passed for his smile. Bob was not a jokester, and his severe demeanor intimidated most people. Word at the bureau was that he had knee surgery not long after 9/11 and declined anesthesia in favor of biting on a leather belt. But I had seen enough to know he had a dry and slightly dark sense of humor. I was seeing it now. "And it was also private, Bob. It was a joke between us." He got it, although he still thought it was funny. From this distance, I can see that he was right. I saw the devilish side of President Bush one cold winter morning, with the city covered by a freshly fallen snow. This frigid morning, Bush was seated in his normal armchair, with his back to the fireplace and close to the grandfather clock. The president was apparently about to head somewhere on Marine One, so as was the custom, reporters were bundled in their winter coats and huddled outside near the Rose Garden to record his departure. As I began briefing the president on a terrorism case, I could hear the sound of his approaching helicopter. The sound grew louder. Stone-faced, the president held up his hand. "Hold on a minute, Jim." He kept his hand aloft to pause me, turned slightly in his chair, and looked out onto the south lawn with Bush one cold winter morning, with the city covered by a freshly fallen snow. This frigid morning, Bush was seated in his normal armchair, with his back to the fireplace and close to the grandfather clock. The president was apparently about to head somewhere on Marine One, so as was the custom, reporters were bundled in their winter coats and huddled outside near the Rose Garden to record his departure. As I began briefing the president on a terrorism case, I could hear the sound of his approaching helicopter. The sound grew louder. Stone-faced, the president held up his hand. "Hold on a minute, Jim." He kept his hand aloft to pause me, turned slightly in his chair, and looked out onto the south lawn where the press corps was gathered. I turned to follow his gaze and watched as the descent of the helicopter swept up the snow on the ground, creating a white-out blizzard that coated all the reporters in snow. Some of them looked like snowmen, embarrassed snowmen. Without any expression on his face at all, Bush turned back to me, dropping his hand. "Okay, go," he said. Bush may have had a slight mean streak. He clearly enjoyed watching that scene, but he understood the humor was essential to the high-stress, high-stakes business we were in. We could be talking with deadly seriousness about terrorism one minute and then filling the Oval Office with laughter the next. It was the only way to get through the job, to intentionally inject some fun and joy into it. But in the White House that day, my friend Bob Trono found nothing joyful or humorous about his meeting with the president. "Who we're waiting on?" Bush asked after he entered the Roosevelt Room 5 minutes before the scheduled start time. Somebody answered that Comey was downstairs in the Situation Room. "Jim can catch up when he gets here," Bush said. "Let's get going." Bob could feel the perspiration trickle down his neck. The meeting marched through the departments as various principals gave the president their briefings. Labor, housing and urban development, education, agriculture. My seat sat empty. Bob's ears began ringing as he realized he didn't even know enough to give the president a bullshit answer. He had neither bull nor shit. Veterans Affairs, Health and Human Services. His head was swimming. He could feel his heart beating through his suit. Commerce, Small Business Administration. Beads of sweat on the back of his neck had by now soaked through his collar. Then the door burst open, and like the cavalry, I strode in. "Hey, Jim, perfect timing," Bush said. "I was just about to turn to justice." I sat and gave my spiel. The president thanked everyone for coming, and the meeting broke up. Bob didn't look happy. "I'm going to kill you," he whispered. Although I may have had a different idea of fun than most, there were some parts of the Justice Department that had become black holes where joy went to die. Places where morale had gotten so low and the battle scars from bureaucratic wrangling with other departments in the White House so deep, I worried that we were on the verge of losing some of our best, most capable lawyers. One of those places was the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, a kind of Supreme Court within the executive branch. Its gifted lawyers, who I often described as an obscure and isolated order of monks, would be given the hardest legal questions by people in other parts of the executive branch. Their job was to think about them well and render an opinion whether a proposed action was lawful, taking into account what the courts, Congress, and any earlier Office of Legal Counsel opinions had said on the topic. This was hard stuff, because often they had very little to go on in forming the opinion. It was harder still when the subject was classified, limiting their ability to talk about it with colleagues. The head of the office was Jack Goldsmith. He was a former law professor and a generally sunny, cherub-faced man. But after only 4 months in his job, his list of problems was starting to dim that angelic glow. He had inherited a set of legal opinions written quickly and under great pressure by his predecessors following the attacks of September 11, 2001. Those lawyers had attested to the lawfulness of aggressive counterterrorism activities by the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security Agency. The president and the intelligence community had relied on those opinions for more than 2 years. The opinions were dead wrong in many places, Goldsmith concluded, and the debate within the Bush administration over them was getting nasty. Goldsmith's primary concern was a then highly classified NSA program codenamed Stellar Wind. Goldsmith and another brilliant department lawyer named Patrick Philbin had concluded that Stellar Wind, a program of NSA surveillance activities conducted in the United States against suspected terrorists and citizens without the need for judicial warrants, had been authorized by their predecessors on legally dubious grounds. Meanwhile, the entire Bush administration had come to rely on the program as a source of intelligence in the fight against terrorism. What Bush appeared not to know was that the NSA was engaging in activity that went beyond what was authorized, beyond even the legally dubious, and into what Goldsmith and Philbin concluded was clearly unlawful. I understood the urgency behind these activities. Just 2 years had passed since the terrorist attacks of 9/11, when 3,000 innocent people had been murdered in our country on a single clear blue morning. That day changed our country, and it changed the lives of all of us in government. We swore to do all we could to prevent such loss again. We would change the government, reshape the FBI, break down barriers, get new tools, and connect dots, all so we could avoid a pain so large as to be almost beyond description. I became the United States Attorney in Manhattan when Ground Zero, where thousands died, still smoldered. Late at night, I would stand at the fence and watch firefighters sift through the dirt to find those lost. Nobody needed to tell me how hard we needed to fight terrorism, but I also understood we had to do it the right way, under the law. Goldsmith and Philbin had shared their concerns with the White House, where the President's Counsel, Alberto Gonzalez, and the Vice President's Counsel, David Addington, were the primary contacts. Of the two, Addington was the dominant force. He was a tall, bearded lawyer with a booming voice that showed just a hint of a Southern accent. In philosophy and temperament, he was a reflection of Vice President Cheney. He did not tolerate fools, and had an ever-expanding definition of those who fit that category. After infuriating Addington by telling him the legal foundation of the program was falling apart, Goldsmith and Philbin then set about trying to convince Addington that I, the new Deputy Attorney General, should be told about, or read into, the Stellar Wind program so I could actually see what was going on. Addington resisted this mightily. Since the program was conceived and authorized, he had succeeded in keeping the number of those who knew the details of the program to an absolute minimum, maybe a couple dozen throughout the U.S. government. 4 people at the entire Justice Department had previously been read into the program, and that did not include my predecessor as Deputy Attorney General. On an activity of such profound importance, one that tested the limits of the law, that small circle was unusual, if not unprecedented. Addington had even arranged to have the documents on the program held outside the normal process for presidential records. He, the vice president's lawyer, kept the orders bearing the president's signatures in a safe in his own office. Eventually, and only after considerable pressure, Addington relented and allowed me to be briefed. In the middle of February 2004, I found myself in a Justice Department secure conference room with the director of the National Security Agency, Air Force General Michael Hayden, getting from him a long-awaited briefing on the highly classified surveillance program. Hayden was an impeccably dressed, amiable man, with wire-rimmed glasses, a bald head, and a talent for folksy sayings and Pittsburgh Steeler references. As we sat down at the table, the general offered a preamble that I will never forget. "I'm so glad you are getting read into this program," he said, "so that when John Kerry is elected president, I won't be alone at the green table." The reference to congressional testimony, behind a table that is often green, was jarring. What was this man about to tell me that required him to express his joy that I would join him in a congressional grilling once a new president arrived? And why on earth would he say such a thing to the second-ranking official of the United States Department of Justice? I had no time to do more than think these questions, because General Hayden plowed right into his briefing. His way of mixing folksy aphorisms and NSA speak was both entertaining and reassuring. The problem, I would come to realize, was that his briefings were a river of really great-sounding stuff that didn't make much sense once the briefing was over and you tried to piece together what you had just heard. After Hayden departed, my Justice Department colleagues, Jack Goldsmith and Patrick Philbin, visibly exhaled. They then explained to me how the surveillance program actually worked and why so much of it was totally screwed up as a matter of both law and practice. The NSA was doing stuff, they maintained, that had no legal basis because it didn't comply with a law Congress had passed a generation earlier, which governed electronic surveillance inside the United States. The president was violating that statute in ordering the surveillance. The NSA was also doing other stuff that wasn't even in the president's orders, so nobody had authorized it at all. This wasn't General Hayden's fault. He wasn't a lawyer or a technologist, and, like Attorney General Ashcroft, who was prohibited from discussing the program even with his personal staff, Hayden was strictly limited in who he could consult about the program. The program was set up as a short-term response to a national emergency, because even Addington knew this was an extraordinary assertion of presidential power, so the president's orders were for short periods, usually about 6 weeks. The current presidential order expired on March 11th. Goldsmith had told the White House that he could not support its reauthorization. Given what I knew, I had to ensure that my boss had all the facts. Many times over the past 2+ years, Ashcroft had approved Stellar Wind, and he needed to know that had been a mistake and could not continue. On Thursday, March 4th, 2004, I met alone with Attorney General Ashcroft to tell him in detail about the problems with the program and why we could not approve another extension. We ate lunch together at a small table in his office. I brought my own store-bought sandwich and butcher paper. It was either turkey or tuna. I was so busy in those days that my assistant, Linda Long, held my money and followed my instructions to alternate those two sandwiches forever. The Attorney General had a fancier setup from his chef, which was good, because I needed the salt and pepper shakers and pieces of silverware to represent parts of the program. I showed him which pieces we could make reasonable arguments to support and which we simply couldn't and that would need to stop or be changed. Ashcroft listened carefully. At the end of the lunch, he said the analysis made sense to him, and we should fix the program to be consistent with the law. I told him we had been keeping the White House informed, and I would now march out and execute on his authority. After our lunch, Ashcroft headed to the United States Attorney's Office across the Potomac in Alexandria to do a press event. He never made it. He collapsed and was rushed to George Washington University Hospital in the District of Columbia with acute pancreatitis, an extraordinarily painful ailment that can also be fatal. By this time, I had gotten on a commercial flight to Phoenix for a government meeting. I learned of the Attorney General's condition as I walked off the plane. My chief of staff, Chuck Rosenberg, called to tell me that with Ashcroft incapacitated, I was now the acting Attorney General and needed to be back in Washington. They were sending a government plane to retrieve me. Back in Washington, I met on Friday with Goldsmith and Philbin. They had communicated the Department of Justice position to the White House. The renewal date was March 11th, 1 week away, and we were not going to support a renewal in the program's current form. That weekend, Goldsmith was summoned to meet with Gonzalez in Addington, but no progress was made. Gonzalez was, as usual, pleasant. Addington was, as usual, angry. Neither man could explain to Goldsmith why we were wrong. Goldsmith had also informed them that I had assumed the duties of the Attorney General. On Tuesday, March the 9th, I was summoned to a meeting at the White House in Chief of Staff Andrew Card's office. Card was a pleasant man who was usually quiet in meetings I attended. He saw his role as ensuring that the process supporting the president worked. He was not an advisor, at least not in my experience. Goldsmith and Philbin were with me. The vice president was presiding. He was sitting at the head of the conference table. I was offered a seat to his immediate left. Also at the table were General Hayden, Card, Gonzalez, FBI Director Bob Mueller, and senior CIA officials. Goldsmith and Philbin found chairs at the far end, down to my left. David Addington stood, leaning against a windowsill behind the table. The first part of the meeting was a presentation by NSA personnel using charts to show me how valuable the surveillance program had been in connection with an ongoing Al-Qaeda plot in the United Kingdom. The intelligence collected had produced a link chart that showed connections among members of a terrorist cell. That was important stuff. Of course, I knew enough about the matter to have serious doubts about whether the NSA's program was needed to find those links, given the other legal tools we had. Still, I said nothing. Our concerns were not based on the usefulness of the program. That was for others to decide. Our job was to certify that the program had a reasonable basis in law. After the analysts rolled up their charts and left the room, the vice president took over. He and I were sitting close enough to touch knees, with Addington out of focus behind Cheney. The vice president looked at me gravely and said that, as I could plainly see, the program was very important. In fact, he said, thousands of people are going to die because of what you are doing. The air in the room felt thin. It was obvious that the purpose of this meeting was to squeeze me, although nobody said that. To have the Vice President of the United States accuse me of recklessly producing another 9/11, even seeming to suggest that I was doing it intentionally, was stunning. He didn't want to hear another side. He didn't seem to accept the obvious truth that there was another side. To him, he was right. Everyone else was wrong, and a bunch of weak-willed and probably liberal lawyers weren't going to tell him otherwise. My head was swimming, the blood rushing to my cheeks in anger, but I regained my footing. "That's not helping me," I said. "That makes me feel bad, but it doesn't change the legal analysis. I accept what you say about how important it is. Our job is to say what the law can support, and it can't support the program as it is." Cheney then expressed a frustration that was entirely reasonable. He pointed out that the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Counsel had written a memo to support the program in 2001, and that the Attorney General had repeatedly certified the program's legality in the 2.5 years since. "How can you now switch positions on something so important?" he asked. I sympathized with him and told him so, but I added that the 2001 opinion was so bad as to be facially invalid. I said no lawyer could rely upon it. From the windowsill came Addington's cutting voice. "I'm a lawyer, and I did." I didn't break eye contact with the vice president. "No good lawyer," I added. It was unusual for me to be nasty like that, but Addington reminded me of someone. He seemed like a bully, not too different in some ways from the kids who picked on me back in school, or even like me when I overturned that poor college freshman's room. I didn't like it. I had lived in a foxhole with Goldsmith and Philbin for the short several months I had been DAG. I had seen the impact of Addington's threats and bullying on these exhausted and fundamentally decent people. In my view, his arrogance was the reason we were in this mess, and these two guys were really good people. I had had enough, so I was nasty. It was no surprise that the meeting ended shortly after, without resolution. Attorney General Ashcroft's Chief of Staff, David Ayers, had been keeping me informed about our boss's condition. The situation was grim. He was in terrible pain in intensive care with an illness that could cause organ failure and death in severe cases like his. Doctors had operated on him the very day I was meeting with the vice president. That Wednesday was strangely quiet on the Stellar Wind front, despite the fact that the current order expired the next day. And then, late that day, Ayers called to pass on Janet Ashcroft's urgent message. Andy Card and Al Gonzalez planned to do an end run around me. They were on their way to the hospital, and I had to figure out what to do. On the way to George Washington University Hospital, I called my chief of staff, Chuck Rosenberg. I deeply trusted him and his judgment. I told him what was happening and asked him to come to the hospital. Then I added, "Get as many of our people as possible." I'm not sure, but I think this was an instinct from my days as a federal prosecutor in Manhattan. When a prosecutor was struggling in court, a call would go out in those days for "All hands to courtroom X." When that announcement came, we would all get up from our desks and go, having no idea what it was about. One of our colleagues needed our support, so we went. Whatever the source of my instinct, Chuck Rosenberg gave it life. He ran to members of my staff, and soon a dozen lawyers were headed to the hospital, having no idea why they were going, except that I needed them there. After that, I called FBI Director Bob Mueller, who was at a restaurant with his wife and one of their children. I wanted Bob Mueller to be a witness to what was happening. Mueller and I were not particularly close and had never seen each other outside of work, but I knew Bob understood and respected our legal position and cared deeply about the rule of law. His whole life was about doing things the right way. When I told him what was happening, he said he would be there immediately. My vehicle screeched to a stop in the driveway of the hospital. I jumped out and ran up the stairs to Ashcroft's floor, relieved to learn that I had arrived ahead of Card and Gonzalez. Ashcroft's intensive care room was at the end of a hallway that had been cleared of other patients. The hall was dimly lit, occupied only by half a dozen FBI agents in suits there to protect the Attorney General. I nodded to the agents and immediately went into Ashcroft's room. He was lying in the bed, heavily medicated. His skin was gray, and he didn't seem to recognize me. I did my best to tell him what was happening and to remind him that this related to the matter we had discussed at lunch before he got sick. I couldn't tell whether he was absorbing any of what I was saying. I then went out into the hall and spoke to the lead agent for Ashcroft's FBI protective detail. I knew Card and Gonzalez would arrive with a Secret Service detail, and, as incredible as it seems now, I feared they might try to forcibly remove me so they could speak with Ashcroft alone. While standing with the FBI special agent, I called Bob Mueller again on his cell phone. He was on his way. "Bob," I said, "I need you to order your agents not to permit me to be taken from Ashcroft's room under any circumstances." Mueller asked me to pass the phone to the agent. I stood as the agent listened, crisply answered, "Yes, sir," and passed the phone back. The agent looked at me with a steely expression. "You will not leave that room, sir. This is our scene." I went back into Ashcroft's room. By this point, Goldsmith and Philbin had joined me. I sat in an armchair just to the right of Ashcroft's bed, staring at the left side of his head. He lay with his eyes closed. Goldsmith and Philbin stood just behind my chair. I didn't know it at the time, but Goldsmith had a pen in his hand, taking detailed notes of what he was seeing and hearing. Janet Ashcroft stood on the far side of the bed, holding her semi-conscious husband's right arm. We waited in silence. Moments later, the hospital room door opened and Gonzalez and Card walked in. Gonzalez was holding a manila envelope at his waist. The two men, both among President Bush's closest confidants, stopped on my side of the bed by Ashcroft's left leg. I could have reached out and touched them. I remember thinking I might have to do that if they tried to get Ashcroft to sign something. But that the idea even crossed my mind seemed crazy. I'm really going to wrestle with these men at the Attorney General's bedside? Gonzalez spoke first. "How are you, General?" "Not well," Ashcroft mumbled to the White House counsel. Gonzalez then began to explain that he and Card were there at the President's direction about a vital national security program, that it was essential that the program continue, that they had briefed the leadership of Congress, who understood the program's value, wanted it continued, and were willing to work with us to fix any legal issues. Then he paused. And then John Ashcroft did something that amazed me. He pushed himself up on the bed with his elbows, his tired eyes fixed upon the President's men, and he gave Card and Gonzalez a rapid-fire blast. "He had been misled about the scope of the surveillance program," he said. He vented that he had long been denied the legal support he needed by their narrow read-in requirements. Then he said he had serious concerns about the legal basis for parts of the program now that he understood it. Spent, he fell back on his pillow, his breathing labored. "But that doesn't matter now," he said, "because I'm not the Attorney General." With a finger extended from his shaking left hand, he pointed at me. "There is the Attorney General." The room was quiet for several beats. Finally, Gonzalez spoke two words, "Be well." Without looking at me, the two men turned toward the door. When their heads were turned, Janet Ashcroft scrunched her face and stuck her tongue out at them. About 5 minutes later, after Card and Gonzalez had left